League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Hi, Matt Beadle here. Thanks for joining us on the Goalkeepers Union podcast. We are back, myself and the voice of goalkeeping, Richard Lee, here for a second season full of all the usual goalkeeping chat. Plenty coming up over the course of the campaign with feature interviews and now a more comprehensive analysis of the action as it happens. So if you're not already aware, we do plan to release two podcasts a week now, one being the classic interview show and the other being the new analysis show. No need to subscribe to a new pod, by the way. They'll both come under the same banner as should appear any time between Monday and Wednesday at the beginning of each week. Now, coming up next is Shay Given, but just a very quick note to say we had a few audio issues at times on this one. Good start. I know what you're thinking. I blame Rich, by the way. However, Shay, as you'd expect, tells some top tales about his career and his current post at Derby. So please do stick with it. It's a really good one. This is the Goalkeepers Union podcast. Enjoy.
To deny Kevin Phillips. Wow.
This week's guest is a man who played for nine clubs over the course of a 23-year career. He's Ireland's record goalkeeping cap holder. He played more than 450 times in the Premier League. At Newcastle, he's the number one when it comes to appearances in European competition for the club. He's been handed the freedom of County Donegal. And I'm sure we'll get onto this, he has previously, of course, been labelled as the only Irishman who doesn't know where Dublin is. Sorry, Shay. Now goalkeeper coach at Derby County. Shay Given, welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
Hi, guys. You okay?
Yeah, good, thanks. Great to have you on, Shay.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Where to start, Shay? I'm actually going to try and bookend it to sandwich everything else in between. Now, you went to Celtic at the beginning of your career as a 16-year-old. I read a quote from you a few months back where you said you were thrilled and nervous at the prospect of starting your career at Celtic, but now you're goalkeeper coach at Derby. And you're thrilled, but you're honoured at this prospect.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy how time goes. I mean, it seems like only yesterday that I joined Glasgow Celtic as a 16-year-old. And I don't plan to do the maths now. 25 years later, I'm sitting talking about my whole career. And you had to start saying nine clubs. I didn't even know I had nine clubs. It's crazy. I left home at 16 and had a choice of going to different clubs. And Celtic was one of them. I was a Celtic fan all my life, still am. And of course, I had an option of going to Celtic or Manchester United, which is a pretty good option for someone from the northwest of Ireland. And, you know, they get scouted in the first place, pretty good. So I had these two options in my head. And to be fair, my dad was sort of my main influence when I was younger. And he was like, we need to go to Celtic because we've got a better chance. If he says, well, you're leaving home, then we want you in the first team. As Peter Schmeichel, I think, was just arriving, or was there every year or two at Man United and had 10 years ahead of him. So my dad's logic was we have a better chance. I think Peggy Bonner at the time was, 34, 35. So he was in the maths, of course, and felt that I had a better opportunity to get into Celtic first team. And of course, being a Celtic fan as well was very special, and to join that club was fantastic for me.
Am I right in thinking, now you're at Derby County, that you actually didn't know Frank Lampard on a personal level before you got the job? Was it a case of, Shearer put in a good word, Harry Redknapp put in a good word for you?
Yeah, it's mad. Yeah, I was just chilling last summer and he called me out of the blue, really. And I mean, I got my badges and stuff. I got my, you know, my A license, B license out. So I got my A because of the goalkeeper. And, you know, I've always said and doing different radio things, you know, you need to get given an opportunity as well. It doesn't matter who you play for or what clubs. You need someone to sort of trust in you and trust you as a coach, because it's, you know, you can play as many games as you want, but it's a totally different, you know, way of looking at things from when you're looking through coach's eyes and you're trying to improve the goalkeepers at the club. And of course, the game's moved on so much now. The goalkeeper's such an important part of the whole team, and you're not just doing goalkeeping stuff. You're working with outfield players as well. And, you know, I think that for me, I'm still learning, obviously, as a coach as well. But, you know, for Frank to bring me in, which was great. And now, obviously, Philip Cocu's here as well, which is fantastic for me for learning as well. He's he gets me involved in everything, and you know, it's a great learning curve for me as well.
I was keen to know if you're always interested in going into goalkeeper coaching, because of course you would have had options post-career, and obviously you've done bits and pieces in the media. No doubt there would have been a blossoming career in the media and still might be, but you've obviously chose to go down the goalkeeper coaching route. And I know from a couple of close friends, Lee Grant being one, Alec Chamberlain being another one who I work closely with at Watford, obviously told me a lot about you and your work ethic. So was it that, the idea that you could actually pass on a lot of what you've learned, a lot of your ideas to younger goalkeepers?
Yeah, I mean, long term, I don't always see myself being a goalkeeper, so I would like to become not necessarily a manager, maybe an assistant or something, because I think I'm good with people. I think I'm good sounding board for the players, to the manager and what have you. But as I say, I'm only in my second year into coaching and learning the trade, really. And I think that's, you know, a number of years maybe down the road. And if I can learn off the likes of obviously Frank Lampard and Philip Cocu and many other coaches, we've got some great coaches here as well at Derby County, then, you know, hopefully that'll stand me in good stead in the future. But you know, I'm still learning as a goalkeeping coach as well. I'm still learning what goalkeepers need, what different sizes of goalkeepers, different, you know, the taller ones might need more work with their feet, or smaller ones might need more stuff in the gym, spring higher, and all the different things you learn and come together with stuff, you know. So it's just bringing it all together, Rich, and obviously hopefully having the goalkeeper ready for a match day on Saturday.
I also read a quote from you, Shay, about the fact that you still felt you were learning, even at the age of 39, when you were at Aston Villa and then, of course, at Stoke. So you're still learning at such a late age. Now, we've seen Adrian go to Liverpool recently. We've seen Andrew Lonergan sign a short-term deal at Liverpool. Yeah. Can they still develop new skills in their 30s? Because this is a question a lot of people are asking, especially after the incident with Adrian at Southampton yesterday. Mm-hmm. Is it possible, in your opinion, and I guess you said it has, that you can still learn at such a late age?
Yeah, well, I mean, I went to Stoke at 39, and the sort of common thing that most goalkeepers do now is they get to sort of spread their arms and they close their knee down. And I think Peter Schmeichel started with sort of spreading the thing, but I think even the block where you jam your knee down and you spread your arms and stuff and try and block, a lot of times balls will go through your legs and stuff, and you think, how can I stop that? Because it's very difficult to get your legs closed at times. So you sort of snap your knee in and raise your arms up. And I've never done that exercise once in my life until I was 39 at Stoke and with Jack Butland there, and they'd done it a lot. And I felt that I wasn't that great at it, to be honest, because I only started at 39. But as you say, I don't think you ever stop learning. I don't think you can ever close the door on new ideas and new techniques. And I'm always scouring, you know, different, I don't know, websites and stuff to see if I can learn, just pick up things and learn things. There was someone in last week from the FA, English FA, giving us a course on the new rule where you can play from the centre half to the goalkeeper inside the box now. That's changed this season, of course, and just shown us different ways. And how would you adapt your session, or how would you, you know, get your goalkeeper and your defence to play out now from the back because the rule has changed. So I think you're always learning.
Well, this is what I was keen to ask you. What tends to happen on this show is that Matt will no doubt delve into your history and talk about key moments in your career. The bit that fascinates me more than anything is that we get a lot of coaches, a lot of young goalkeepers that will listen into the show, and it will be things like that, the way in which the game has changed, the way in which, say, you trained, which, you know, we're talking now 20 years on since you started, slightly longer than that, sorry, 25 years on since you really started making a name
remind
for yourself.
Me, don't remind me.
No, but you and me both. But do you know what? I think back to what I was taught when I was even 11, 12 years old, joining Watford as a 10-year-old, the kind of things I was taught then, goalkeeping's changed completely now, where really the back pass rule only came in when I was about 12 years old. I guess for you it would have been, what, 14, 15, I guess, it would have come in for you.
Yeah,
so
that's right, yeah.
You don't necessarily learn the kind of skills that you'll see the Edisons and Allisons and these guys learning, because it wasn't a thing back then. But of course now, I guess when you're coaching goalkeepers, you're probably having to coach in a different way to the way in which you were being coached.
Yeah, definitely. I think when it comes to a match day as well, you probably use your hands. I'm not sure what the percentage is, but 10 or 20%, maybe 15% of the game is with their hands, and the rest as well. I think you have to do a lot more exercise with the ball at your feet, you know, I don't know, back passes, you know. I even get the young lads up. I get the young lads up sometimes from the under 23s, under 18s, to come and help me with sessions, because, you know, to go and press the goalkeeper and get them playing out from the back under pressure and under, you know, it's difficult to reenact that with just two or three goalkeepers. But you bring the outfield players involved in the session as well, and what you're going to get on a match day, of course. And I think the more comfortable they are, and to be fair to Keller, who's our number one here, Derby, he's very comfortable with the ball at his feet, and our defence have to trust him. We've got a few new signings this year, but they have to realise how good he is with the ball at his feet, because it's a real asset to the team, and trust him more with the ball at his feet. But yeah, you have to adapt the sessions, and you have to, as you say, from the day we started, we did very little, probably kicking really. It was all to do with diving around the goal and stuff, and of course you have to do that as well, but I think you have to do a lot more with your feet now as well.
So I'm keen to talk, Shay, about integration. Now, there's a UEFA license now, which your fellow countryman Paki Bonner oversees at UEFA. And the B license is all about your goalkeeper basics. It's catching, it's claiming, it's what we know goalkeeping to be. But the A license, I believe, focuses more on integration and the wider aspect of coaching. And you get involved in set plays and set pieces and corner kicks at Derby, right?
Yeah, I would like to think from an organisational point of view, I've always been good with that. Even when I played, I was always just a natural of leading and putting people in different positions when it comes to, for example, set plays, and that hasn't changed. But you say Paki Bonner doing my A-license as well, doing it in Belfast with Paki, and he's our tutor and stuff, and very much, you know, it's not just the goalkeeper coach, as Rich was saying before, goes off into the corner and we'll see you in half an hour or 45 minutes and come and join in with the lads. And yeah, we still do that to a certain degree, but very much coach involved in the meeting and what we're going to do for the day and how I can interact my session with theirs and, you know, sort of interact. Like today, for example, we're playing out from the back with 6v5 with the keeper. So his keeper was one of the six and playing out, you know, under a bit of pressure. And we had that meeting this morning, and obviously my warm-up then was adapted to what we were going to do with outfield players, and it was more comfortable sort of transition for them then.
Okay, well, we're going to move on to your career now. Like we said, we don't have time to go through your entire career, but I've picked out some tidbits. And the first one is the two promotions in the same season, loan spells at Swindon and Sunderland. Swindon went up from League One, Sunderland went up from the Championship, but you played for two teams on loan and bagged two promotions in the same campaign.
Not many people know that, do they?
There you go.
When I went to Swindon, it was to get out on loan, and of course, you know, Swindon was a good option. Steve McMahon was player manager at the time, and I went, and I think it was only five games I played in the end because Tim Flowers got sent off and I had to come be on the bench for Blackburn, and which was a bit of a disappointment. But I'd rather stay at Swindon and play more games. But of course, your parent club had to say, and you know, the rules were different as well. They had the option of calling you back straight away, so that's what happened. And then, of course, Sunderland, I was 19 at the time, went to Sunderland for 3 months, and before Kenny Dalglish was the manager at Blackburn, he said to Peter Reid, you can have him, but you know, he needs to play. There's no point in going up there and he's sitting on the bench. He may as well stay with us. And Peter Reid called me on the Thursday, I think it was, and he goes, you better bring your hair gel for the weekend. I goes, why? He goes, well, you're live on TV. You're playing Leicester away in your first game, so you'll be starting. So, you know, it was fantastic for a young, inexperienced 19-year-old to be given that sort of, I don't know, responsibility. And of course, it was a fantastic 3 months. And as you say, we won promotion to back to the Premier League.
It was interesting. So Alec Chamberlain was with me at Watford, and of course he had his time at Sunderland, and you came in for Alec. And I always remember him telling me the story of how that happened, because he was getting a real rough time from what I remember at Sunderland. Obviously, brilliant career, Chamber, certainly at Watford, you know, living legend at Watford, certainly. But he did say during that time at Sunderland, the fans are so passionate up there and they had turned against him. But he said he'll always remember you coming in. At the time, you were so young. And of course, I suppose for any goalkeeper, a 19-year-old coming in, you know, it puts your nose out of joint to an extent. But he said the day that he saw you, I think it might have been the first session he saw, and he understood exactly what all the hype was about, and said just how well you did thereafter.
Alex was fantastic, because you're taking his position. That's the thing of a goalkeeper. There's only one player can play, and it's not good for Alex, but it was good for me. And obviously, you know, for Peter Reid to tell me I was going to be starting. And of course, it's down to me then. If I didn't play well, then I wouldn't be in the team. But you know, it was a great opportunity for me to go there and play in the Championship. You know, it was fantastic in front of passionate fans at Roker Park, and we had a great run, of course, and Alex was a great support behind all that, and people don't see that at times with the backup goalkeeper as well, helping you every day in training, especially someone so young at 19. Yeah, you need all the help, you know, you can get, and obviously Alex's experience was fantastic as well.
Yeah, well, interestingly, and the few people that I know that have worked with you, Lee Grant being another one, and he touched on the fact that he said even, you know, at Stoke that you were still the hardest worker out there, that the point was for you that, you know, even he said you had a couple of injury bits and pieces at the time, but the competitiveness really shone through, and the fact that you wanted to outwork everybody around you. Has that always been a key aspect of your training?
Yeah, very much so. Me playing football or even now coaching, I think I'm, you know, absolutely won the lottery, really, to have made a career, made a life out of playing football. Just, you know, it's, even just saying it to you guys now, I still find it hard to believe that, you know, that I can pay the bills and pay a mortgage or whatever and have a house. And even still to this day, still, you know, thanks to a size 5 football that I'm, you know, got a job, really, because I just feel lucky and privileged to be in a position where, you know, the football's given me so much in my life and shown me so much of the world. It's amazing what as I say, a size 5 football can do. But you know, I've been very lucky and fortunate. And of course, you need the work. You have to work. Of course, you have to do. I think you have to do that in every walk of life, whatever you want to be. But I've always had that. I've seen that. You know, most managers had to drag me off the pitch because I wanted to do one more, or give me, you know, 5 more shots or 5 more volleys or whatever it was. I just wanted to do that bit extra, and I don't mind staying out doing extra with the goalkeepers and trying to improve them.
Now, Shay, when we talk about goalkeepers and the way people judge goalkeepers, on the most part, is clean sheets. Now, I know you're not a huge advocate of this. I know Rich isn't a huge advocate of clean sheets being the be-all and end-all for goalkeepers. And we had Joe Hart on the podcast who was talking about the fact that the Golden Gloves should maybe be looked at. And look, he's won 4 along with Petr Cech. He's up there with the most Golden Gloves in the Premier League. But he said maybe it should be judged a bit differently now. So I'm just going to read out some stats first before we get on to your opinions. But 4 clean sheets in your first 5 games for Swindon. That was your first 5 games as a pro. 12 in 17 for Sunderland. 10 on loan at Borough for that second half of the season. You've got a clean sheet and man of the match on your debut for Man City, and your clean sheet on your debut for Villa. There are hundreds more in the Premier League and, of course, with Ireland. What is your view on the Golden Gloves and clean sheets as a whole?
Every week it's, match of the day, for example, goal of the week or goal of the month and all this kind of stuff. And it's as if the goalkeepers don't exist in my eyes at times. And I think, for example, in times gone by, the budget will all be on a striker, and then we'll maybe need midfielders, and then if there's any money left, we'll you get the defence sort of. But if we've got no money left, we'll just drag somebody in and put a pair of gloves on them and chuck them in the goal, you know. But it's quite refreshing to see now that, you know, Liverpool spent $70 million on Alisson. I think City paid 30 or 40 for Ederson. You know, Kepa's gone to Chelsea for $70 million. I think, you know, people have finally woke up to see how important the position is, because, you know, if you can make it a, you know, unbelievable save and saves your team a goal, then it's, you know, it's as good as scoring, Dylan, in my opinion. And, you know, I think that's, from my point of view, quite refreshing. And the clean sheet thing is one that sort of riles me a little bit as well, because you could be man of the match and, you know, something get deflected in the last second of the game and it goes into the net or an OG or whatever it is. Like, and that doesn't take away from, you know, a fantastic performance that you've had maybe in the past. And, you know, it's difficult because the top teams at the very top will keep more clean sheets than the bottom 5 or 6. But that doesn't mean the goalkeepers in the bottom 5 or 6 are not as good as the ones in the, you know what I mean? I just feel that there's a big sort of gap there between, I don't know, how would you vote the best goalkeeper, I suppose, without the clean sheets? But I think the clean sheets, in a sense, the Golden Glove is more, you know, a team thing. If you've got a team that's all at attack, then you're going to probably concede more goals. But it's just getting a balance right between defence and attack. And that's not just down to the goalkeeper. I think that's down to how the team wants to play.
This actually is a big subject for me because, and in fact, we're recording this the week of Liverpool winning the Super Cup and Adrian making the penalty save to win the Super Cup. And of course, he was back pages everywhere. And credit to him. Fantastic moment for him. And he's the hero. But of course, if you were to look at the game as a whole, now that particular game, I'm thinking, if I'm putting myself in Adrian's shoes, he's given away a penalty during the game, which he might look at and think maybe he might have made a different decision. But of course, in the end, it's worked his way. And this is kind of how I feel that we evaluate goalkeepers, that suddenly he's the hero, but it's not a balanced view of his performance. Similarly, you get the goalkeeper who plays very, very well, distributes brilliantly, comes through his crosses, makes good saves, positioning's good, communication's good, but makes one error maybe and you lose 1-0. And of course, he is then the villain, even though overall it's a very, very good performance. But there isn't, from what I see, and I know the stats are getting slightly better, but there isn't a definitive way of analysing a goalkeeper for the effectiveness of that goalkeeper. And because the position seems to be changing all the time, it does seem to be quite hard. And certainly, I guess, with a lot of the pundits, this must have been quite interesting for you when you did your work in the media to actually be able to give a bit of a goalkeeping perspective.
Yeah, definitely, because I think in the media thing, definitely, you know, people just see, I don't know, goals going in. And a lot of time, if a goal goes in, you know, commentators or pundits go, the keeper should do better. And then if a keeper saves it, or even penalties, for example, a keeper saves a penalty, oh, it's a nice height for him. And it's never, there's never any real credit, I don't think, given to a goalkeeper. And the modern football as well moves so many different directions now and different ideas. And you get a lot of keepers that parry stuff away now. And, you know, and you get people on the back of my day, you know, that keeper would have caught that. I don't know what's he doing and punching things and stuff. And the game has evolved and has changed. And I think we have to change with it. As you said, Adrian, last week, which is most recent, you know, as you said, gave a penalty away and they get back to 2-2, and had Chelsea won the thing on penalties, it would have been, I don't know, Adrian disaster, lets Chelsea back in to lose a penalty shootout. You know, I don't know, people in media, and that's just the way it is, they can spin it whatever way they want. And then obviously he made a bad mistake at the weekend at Southampton, and it's like, oh, you know, Liverpool are going to miss Alisson so much because this guy's not good enough. And 3 days before that, he was the hero. So you know, I think, especially when it comes to goalkeeping, I think you have to sort of put the blinkers on a little bit and focus what you can sort of control and control the controllables. I've always said you can't legislate for someone, I don't know, scoring a worldy goal past you or your own defender putting one past you. You sometimes just have to control your game and what you can do within that game. And you know, you can't really control what pundits say or what the press say. And, of course, social media now is massive. And, you know, if you go on your social media after and you've made a mistake, then your granny could play in goal ahead of you. That kind of way, you know, it's that sort of mentality that if you make a mistake, then it's, go to hell, he's getting, I don't know, 20 grand a week. You know, how the hell has he made that mistake? Because he shouldn't, because he's getting that much money. You know, it's just crazy that we're all human beings, but we're not allowed to make mistakes.
I've got to tell you, Shay, that Rich's eyes lit up then when you said the term controlling the controllables, because we often talk about mindset and psychology on this show. And actually, I'll touch on that now, because primarily you've been a number one wherever you've played, but there have been instances in your career when you've lost your place at Villa, at Newcastle, at Man City when Joe Hart came in, and at Stoke, like we've discussed. So Steve Harper in particular, that period in the late 90s that you were both sort of battling for that jersey, the FA Cup final, you played one year, he played the other. There have been transfer requests that you've put in and then you've retracted, and this is all down to mindset, right? And there was one particular game against Liverpool that I recall you saying that you were almost not done with football, but you felt really low. And I think a lot of goalkeepers feel like that. Rich can certainly attest to that. What's going through your mind in terms of getting back to where you need to be? And in terms of not playing football, obviously you put in that transfer request, but you almost then realised that it was purely because you just wanted to play.
Yeah, we're probably going back to the start of this, you know, podcast was kind of about, you know, my dad, when I left home, it was like, we're leaving to go to Celtic, not to Man United, because we have the best chance of playing the first team. And it was my idea when I put the transfer question. It was more to do with, I've got one career, I've got one life in football, and I want to play as many games as I can. I want to play every week. I don't want to miss a single game. And me not playing or being on the bench for 1 week is bad enough, but for maybe 2 months or 3 months, then it's like, oh, this is not good at all. This is I'm wasting my life here. I'm wasting my career. I'm wasting time, really, because I'm missing out on all these games. These games I'll never get back. That wasn't me. I wasn't happy to sit on the bench. And yeah, you said Man City. Joe came in and I was out. And I was like, well, yeah, a lot of people will be happy to stay at Man City, a fantastic club, but not me. I wanted to go and play. I wanted to get back out and play and show the people that, yeah, I'm 34, 35, whatever it was, but I'm still good enough to be playing the Premier League. And you know, maybe other people might have sat back and goes, oh, this is me cushioning now for, you know, just sit back and put my feet up as such, but, you know, just take it easy and be number two and be happy with it. But that was never my mentality, you know.
In terms of favourite saves, we often ask goalkeepers this. You've had some great ones over the years. Of course you have. I think the Kevin Phillips save in the Tyne Wear derby. You made a great save, obviously, against Kevin Phillips. That was a big save at the time when you were chasing promotion that season. I believe it was up for save of the decade on Premier League's 10-year anniversary. Yeah. You've made a great save from Zinedine Zidane. You made some great saves against Iran for the Republic of Ireland. There are so many. Is there any that stick out for you in general?
Probably the ones you mentioned, really, I suppose. I don't know. There's probably loads of saves you forget as well. Someone mentioned already about saving balls with your head. I saved a couple in my head because I've got a big square block head, you know. But I think that comes down to keeping the ball out of the net. I say to the lads, I do exercise. I've got tee the ball up on a cone now, and I do this exercise off the post at the minute, and it comes off the cone like a rocket, like, you know. And sometimes you just pick it right in the head or in the nose or in the face, and I'm like that. And the ball's kept out. So I don't really care if I broke your nose, and I genuinely don't. But you kept the ball out of the net. That is the most important thing. And looking back, yeah, there have been some big saves, of course, because you wouldn't play probably for that long, you know. But probably the one for me would be probably Iran, when we played Iran in Dublin. We won 2-0, but I made a save second half. It was massive because a few days later we had to go to Iran, and there was 100,000 men in the stadium for 5 hours before the game. And you can imagine if they had needed one goal, which they did get in the 93rd minute over there, what the atmosphere would have been like in that stadium. And we managed to, you know, get across the line and to play in the World Cup finals, which was a dream of mine, because growing up in Ireland, used to support the Jack Charlton era and the team that were, you know, just lit up the whole country. So I was a huge fan of Ireland growing up, as you can imagine. And then to be able to go full circle, to actually walk out, you know, in Japan and Korea and be the number one for your country. And, you know, even talking about the hairs in the back of my neck are standing now, it's just a special feeling to have done that. And no one can ever take that away.
Yeah, I actually want to ask you, you mentioned hair stand off back of your neck. I want to ask you about St James's Park. I want to ask about Newcastle. Now, I don't know if you remember this or not, but I was fortunate enough to play a few games in the Premier League. One of them was away at Newcastle against yourself. And you were very kind in order to give me your shirt at the end of the game, which I still have, still very much a treasured collection of mine. So thank you for that. I don't know if you remember the game, actually, but Obafemi Martins got a winner in the last minute, which was a shame. We lost 2-1. But what I want to ask you about St James's Park, that was the only game I ever got to play there. I was fortunate enough to play at Old Trafford, play at the Etihad and a few others. For me, though, that game, even though it was Newcastle v Watford, which wasn't a particularly big game for Newcastle at the time, but the atmosphere was incredible. You got to play in front of that atmosphere week in, week out for a number of years. How was that, you know, for our young goalkeepers listening who have dreams of aspirations of playing in the Premier League, playing at some of these biggest stadiums, how was that going out in front of them every week?
Yeah, it's very special. I think even still to this day, all the clubs have played at, I think when St James's Park is rocking, and I don't think there's a better atmosphere in the Premier League. I really don't. And I think it's just, you know, the fans are so passionate about their football club. They live and breathe the football club. They work, obviously, every day to go to the football at the weekend. And when things are going well, the atmosphere is phenomenal. You know, say the best you could probably get. And I remember playing Barcelona in the Champions League that once up there, and we, you know, we beat them 3-2 in the Champions League, and I think Tino Spray got a hat-trick, and, you know, it was just, I could be shouting within a yard of you and you would not hear a word I was saying to you, you know, and it was just electric, and you know, you felt 10 foot tall, and you felt, you know, you felt a bit of a hero in Newcastle, I suppose, to a certain degree, but you had to be a certain type of player as well, you know, go back to the mindset again, because if you give a bad pass away or made a mistake, then, you know, in 52,000 or I make a moan or a groan, then, you know, you feel like your roof's coming in a bit, so you have to have a certain character as well to be able to play for Newcastle and play for some of the other big clubs as well, because, you know, it takes us, it's easy to get on the ball when you're 1-2 and 3-0, but when you want the ball when you're losing or whatever, or you're chasing a game or you've made a mistake or a bad pass or something you should have done better with, then it takes a certain character or a certain individual to have broad shoulders, to have strong body language, to walk around and say, well, that didn't affect me, you know, bring it on, bring the next one. You know, we all make mistakes, as I say, so you have to have a certain, I think, mentality, definitely, to play there.
Do you think that's even stronger this season, Shay? Obviously, the problems that they've got there at the moment are well-documented, or problems from the fans' perspective, I suppose. But in terms of the players and where they go moving forward, and Steve Bruce is obviously the boss, and there's various bits and pieces going on at boardroom level that we don't have to get into. But in terms of character for Newcastle players now and their relationship with the fans, is that probably the most important now than it's ever been?
Yeah, it's a tough one because obviously the owner's still there and the fans obviously they just want him out. So it's a very difficult one because they love their football club, but they don't love the owner. But, you know, at the same time, they're still within the players. And I think to a certain degree, Steve Bruce as well, I know he's just come into the job. So they need to give him time to do his job, really, basically. But I think if they can get a few victories and get turn it around, then the fans will most definitely support the team. And, you know, there's recent weeks talking about boycotts and stuff, but the first home of the game against the season, yeah, there were a couple of spare seats, but there's still nearly 50,000 people. You know, they can't bring it within themselves to not go to the game because, as I said before, they just love the football club, and in an ideal world they would have a new owner that would invest a lot more in the team and try and push, because I feel the Newcastle should be up, you know, challenging and not obviously every season trying to avoid relegation, because it is a great club. That's the problem at the minute, because there's the fans, like, they don't get on with the owner, of course they don't, and can turn a bit toxic, of course, if you go 1-0 down, whatever, and maybe years gone by would go the opposite. If he lost the goal at St James's, the fans would go the other way and really get behind the team even more to lift them. And I think they just need to get back to that.
We've been very positive, but I have to ask you the question, because it wouldn't be the Goalkeepers Union podcast if I didn't. Dion Dublin. Did you? I'm sorry. Sorry for being so predictable. But that goal against Coventry, what I'm interested in, I suppose, is the reaction of the players after the game. Was there a bit of banter? Have you spoken to Dion Dublin since about that incident?
Yeah, we'd done something last year ago with TV, and he snuck up behind me on the TV studio. Like, and we'd done a picture, I think it's on my Instagram. Actually, it was quite funny. But it wasn't quite funny at the time when Dion Dublin came to death there from the bench. But when he showed me as well, they just showed me, like, just throwing the ball out and Dion Dublin sneaking up. But I forget the confidence, long cross. I didn't even know Dion Dublin was even challenging me. I was that. And then Dion Dublin's momentum took him off the pitch, and he just sat on the advertising board. And then it was like, people don't realise, well, that was the very first season when the 6-second rule came in. So you had an option of taking the ball along, you know, quickly, whatever, 6 seconds, or you had to drop it down, which I did. You know, obviously, stupidly, I didn't look behind me. And the other thing was Alan Shearer was up, and he never moved, like, hold the ball as long as I could. So looking back, I can laugh about it now and stuff, but at the time, obviously, it wasn't funny. And I think the ref blew, like, think it was a free kick because he must have thought I kicked it out of my hands or something. And for about a split second, I thought maybe I can talk my way out of this.
Yeah.
But the right decision in the end was made. It was a bad mistake for me and obviously a goal for him through. But yeah, the joke after was the only Irishman not to know where Dublin is. So that was I've had to live with that forever probably. So people keep showing it. So now you have to learn from that. You know, thing that I've never ever done it again. And that was key. If I'd done it maybe 2 years later, then he was like, "Well, did you not learn?" Yeah. There was other goalkeepers after me who'd done it as well, and I'm thinking, surely you must have learned from the first person to do it. But no, that's what I'm saying. Goalkeeping and life in general, you have to learn from your mistakes and not let that affect you. You have to be, as I say, have broad shoulders. You have to have a strong mentality and a strong belief that, you know, next week or the next save or the next minute of the game, you have to park at the one side and deal with what comes next.
Just on that note, I just want to labour that point a bit because, again, goalkeeper coaches, young goalkeepers listening in, that's one of the biggest things about goalkeeping. It's all good and well when things are going your way and you're making great saves and you're winning and so on and so forth. But I'm sure you, as I, have been there when you've lost 1-0 and you know that it was your fault for that particular goal. And this is where mindset and resilience is such a big part of goalkeeping. Did you have any strategies yourself, any advice that you can pass on in terms of how to deal with setbacks, with mistakes?
Yeah, well, I was probably my toughest critic when I played and my early part of my career was too tough for me at Newcastle. I actually seeked out some help with a psychologist and you know, went off my own back because I think back then it was seen maybe as a weakness if you had, not really that psychological problem, but I was just so hard on myself when a mistake happened, then I would be thinking about it for, you know, maybe even the rest of the game, and then that might lead to a second mistake. And I managed to get in touch with the physio at Newcastle at the time. Actually, he got me in touch with the sports psychologist in Cardiff, who was a former goalkeeper, and we sat down for hours on time, just, you know, talking through what we should do and how to combat and how not to be so hard on yourself and how to, I don't know, it's I suppose it's self-help in a sense when you're on the pitch. You know, you make a mistake, maybe stick it in the glove bag, whatever, zip up the bag, and we'll deal with it after the game. And what's important is the next sort of action within that game. Yeah, you sit down after the game with your coach or get the video analyst guys to have a look at it and what would you have done differently or how could you improve. And that was a big help for me. I had things to do that could park mistakes or things that happened in a game or even scores or if they've scored or whatever, just different things that would happen to any goalkeeper in their career and ways of dealing with it. And it was a big help to me. I was way too hard on myself and would maybe lead on to further mistakes within the game. And this was a big help for me to deal with that.
Well taken, though, by Shea Given. Well, what's Shea Given doing? Dublin comes back on and turns it into the net. Oh, my word. Brilliant take there by the young Irish goalkeeper. But he looks around, but he's not aware that Dion Dublin went off the pitch behind him. Dublin comes back on and says, "Thank you very much," and turns it into the net, and I'm sure that goal will stand.
2010 World Cup qualifier, Thierry Henry, France away from home, the infamous handball that we all know about. Of course, France went on to play in the World Cup and Ireland sadly didn't that year. You were obviously the closest player to what happened there. Just run us through your thought processes as that happened and the reaction to it.
Yeah, I mean, it was so blatant. I was just running to get the ball to take a free kick because it was nearly like Henry realised it was that blatant that you know, obviously he's going to get a free kick given against him and you know, he hit his forearm and then he pulled it back in with his left hand as well. So it was like a double handball, you know. And it was literally that obvious. It was like, oh, that's a free kick. And I've turned around and the referee's, you know, pointing to the centre of the pitch for a goal. And I'm like, you have to be kidding me. Like, it's just, I look to the linesman. He's running up to the halfway line as well. And it's like, what's happening here? It's like, is this really happening? It's probably the quickest I've ever moved in my life, you know, sprinting to the referee because it was just a... It was a real injustice, really. We just felt whatever, cheated or wrong by such a blatant handball, really, because that's how obvious it was. It wasn't like it was if, you know, it should have been missed. It was just so obvious that, you know, we clearly handballed it. And on the back of that, we don't go to a World Cup final. And that's not just one game. You know, you go away for 18 months or 20 months, whatever it is, and you're away from your family and you're sacrificing lots of things to play in a World Cup finals again. And we felt we were robbed by, you know, such a poor decision by the officials.
And he was sat in the centre circle there. I'll never forget those images where he sat with Richard Dunn, and you can tell that Dunn's a bit like, well, you can give me all the excuses you want and you can apologise as much as you want, but what's happened has happened. Did you ever speak to Thierry Henry after that moment?
I'd done a couple of things with him. He never really had done a Q&A with him once, and someone asked him, and he goes, "Oh, I'm not answering that," or something. He didn't really want to answer it, I suppose. And to be fair to Thierry, I felt it was more, well, yes, he handballed it, but we probably see it every week on the Premier League or in the Championship. We see that happening all the time. It's probably, but most referees would see it, and especially such a blatant one like that, you know. So, yeah, you can blame Thierry, but for me, it was probably more the officials got it wrong, and it was that blatant that they come back over it again. It was that blatant that it wasn't a hard decision to make.
Just on superstitions, Shay, we often talk about this as well. I know Rich had a few when he was playing. Brad Friedel used to speak about what he did in terms of staying on the line, staying on the white lines when action was going on at the other end of the pitch. You used to carry holy water with you in the back of your net. Talk to us about that.
I did in the early part. Like my dad, when I left home, my dad gave us a bottle of holy water, basically, and I had it, you know, back in the day, and didn't do it anymore. But I used to always carry a glove bag with me, and it was just a bit random because my dad was a goalkeeper as well, so I used to have this glove bag, and they'd have chewing gum in it, and they'd have, I don't know, a spare set of gloves or whatever. So I sort of, you know, not all my career, but you know, first, I don't know, 5 or 6 years when I left home, I had this bag with holy water, spare gloves, like it was like as if someone couldn't bring me on some spare gloves. But that was, you know, we're talking whatever 25 years ago, you know. So it's something, to be fair. I don't know if it's superstitious or my religion or whatever, you know, but maybe just like a comfort thing, and I'd probably bless myself before the game in the changing room with it and what have you. And yeah, you can call it superstitious or religion or whatever, you know, but, you know, with little things we all do, probably we've all done. And, you know, if you got man of the match with a pair of gloves on, you might wear them again the next week because they were on fire the week before or whatever. And even though there's a hole in them or something, or just little things, put your boots on or last, or you go out last or whatever. You never used to put my gloves on when I was doing the walk up across the line because I was fearing in case someone in Vaseline on the opposition team would try and scupper me gloves and stuff, and I would just shake hands with a bare hand. And then obviously after the walk, you know, when you meet the teams, I would put the gloves on after that, and just different things that I suppose people call superstition or just being clever. I didn't want my gloves to get covered in Vaseline of the opposition, even though they probably didn't have any, but I didn't want to take the chance. And, you know, little things like that. And I suppose it's everything to mentally make you feel right going into a game.
Last but not least, we always ask every goalkeeper this. This is season 2 of these podcasts, but it is the very same question that we ask every goalkeeper at the end of the podcast, which is, Shay, given you've been involved in goalkeeping for the majority of your life, what has goalkeeping given you?
It's given me everything, really. A pair of gloves and a football has given me a passport to the world, really. You know, I've been all around the world with football and seen so many things that, you know, I just wouldn't have seen, and so many people, and met so many different amazing people, and played in some unbelievable stadiums in the world, and stuff growing up in Ireland and in the northwest of Ireland thought that could never happen, and would just, you know, people would say, "Well, you want to be when you get older?" So I want to be a footballer, and but saying that, thinking, you know, that's never going to happen because, one, no one's going to find me in Donegal, and two, you know, maybe I wasn't good enough. But football's given me everything, and you know, I'm sitting here now, Derby County training ground, you know, still every day living and breathing football, and that'll probably never change.
Shay, top stuff. Thank you very much for joining us.
No problem at all, lads.
Terrific. That was Shay Given, mate. You took his shirt. I'm presuming he asked for yours.
He didn't.
Oh.
No, I'm assuming he must have. Right. I don't know. Maybe he'd already got it on like an auction or something. I don't know. Maybe he already had one. He had too many. I don't know. But he didn't at the time. I'm sure there's reasons for it.
How many times did that happen to you in your career? Because we've had Lee Grant on, who we've spoken loads about in that particular podcast, but your shirt is in his loft in a box stuffed. Has anybody that you know asked for your shirt and had it framed?
No. I mean, the ones I swapped with Van der Sar, he didn't ask mine, but I'm guessing that was probably the fact that mine would have been a little bit small for him because he was like double XL and I was a medium. So maybe that was the reason with Van der Sar. Brad Friedel, similarly, spent a whole year with Brad, but he decided against it. Again, maybe he wasn't a Watford fan. It could have been something really, really simple. So there's no point reading into this kind of stuff.
Okay. Well, I mean, the chat as a whole was really interesting. Look, there was so much that we missed out as well. So listeners, we're going to try and get Shay on at a future date because there's so much more of his career that we can discuss. I mean, the fact that he was on the bench, his Celtic debut, although he didn't play and he never played for Celtic, he was on the bench. And the first time he was on the bench was for an Old Firm in 1994, and it went bonkers, pitch invasions and all sorts. So I'd love to have known what that experience was like for him. His pro debut for Blackburn was against Wimbledon. You know, when height of the crazy gang. So that must have been very interesting. So much to talk about.
Yeah, no, definitely. No, massive character. Look, you ask anybody in the world of goalkeeping. One of the key things for me, and this is where even recently we both spoke to Lee Grant, and I know from speaking to Alec Chamberlain before, it was the work ethic. Because the other thing about Shay Given, and again, this is something I'd love to touch on in a future podcast with him, is that he's not a 6'5" monster of a goalkeeper, which again, lots of people listening in will share this same issue in that if you're not 6'3", 6'4", of course, managers, a lot of managers want that 6'3", 6'4" goalkeeper. Of course, Shay Given, 6'1", I believe. So he's not huge in terms of stature, but he always made the absolute most of what it was that he offered. And from what I understand from talking to people, it was very much about work ethic. He would make sure, if nothing else, he would outwork you.
Of course, the other thing about Shay Given was that there was no grand finale for him. He retired after he'd finished the season at Stoke. He thought he was going to get another season, but that didn't pan out. So his retirement basically came in a chat at the Ballsbridge Hotel in Dublin. He was named the 40th Donegal Person of the Year, which I think is brilliant, because he was actually given the freedom of County Donegal at some point during his career. But that's when he announced it. So there was no farewell game. There was no big round of applause.
I quite like this, because you often find this is the case. It's very rare that a goalkeeper gets that moment when they have their big hurrah and that's them and they sail off into the sunset. Sometimes it can be manipulated. I remember with, I think, Alec at Watford, that happened where they were able to bring him on the last few minutes of a game and he had his big send-off. But more often than not, it doesn't happen. It's a case of, you know, I know recently, talking about this podcast, Ashley Cole, for instance, it's not necessarily that you get your big send-off. Because what will often happen is the season finishes, you will then look to see what else might be out there. And it might just be the case that there isn't anything out there. Because, of course, the older you get, then you've got a decision. Do you want to drop down to the Championship, League One, League Two, in order to continue your football? And when you've played at the level that Shay Given has, when you played at the level that Ashley Cole and some of these others have, then maybe you're ready for the next chapter. And certainly the impression I get is that Shay Given was ready for that. And I've got no doubt that even now at the age he's at, he could still play League One probably very, very comfortably.
Do you think?
I'm sure he could. But then this is where I'm sure some of the top goalkeepers could probably still play well into their 40s in League Two. And that's no disrespect to League Two. It's just the fact that someone like Shay Given, the experience that he's got, that will take you a long, long way. You imagine having Shay Given at goal, even well into his 40s. Okay, he might not have the spring that he once had. He might lose a few yards in distance when it comes to his kicks, etc., etc. But actually, if he keeps himself fit, the experience, the way in which he can influence his defenders, he would be a valuable, valuable asset for any team. But I just think you get to a point where when you've done it at the absolute highest level, then you're ready to move on. And I think he's certainly in a position now where he's able to pass on some of the information that he's learned. And imagine if you're a young goalkeeper working with Shay Given now, the amount you could learn from him.
Well, it's funny you say that, Richard, because he has the distinction of going to clubs in Manchester City and Stoke where bright English young talent was coming through. Of course, at Man City, Joe Hart, when Shay Given initially signed, went on loan. He came back and then took Shay Given's place. At Stoke, he came in when Jack Butland was there. So it'd be really interesting to know whether they learned from Shay Given. And also what's fascinating is Roberto Mancini, who took over from Mark Hughes, who signed Shay Given and would have worked with Kevin Hitchcock, I imagine, said at the time that Shay Given was one of the top five goalkeepers in the world. Joe Murphy, who we know as a great goalkeeper over his years in the lower leagues, has said that Shay Given is the greatest goalkeeper he's ever, ever seen.
And this is something that still gets then underestimated for me, because now he's moving into the coaching world. And I won't give specific examples about the bad coaches, because that's not for me to do. But certainly there are certain coaches out there that I know are fantastic. And what then they do and what they're able to, like a good personal trainer, they can push you to your absolute limits and they'll know how to maximize your game. So, you know, it's like sometimes, like the example I'll give is if you're going to go for a run on your own, you know, you'll go for a run and you'll finish your run and you'll do it okay. Now, if you go for a run with a mate or with a personal trainer, you'll push yourself that much harder because you've got someone there pushing you and making you work that little bit harder. It's exactly the same with a goalkeeper coach. You can have an average goalkeeper coach. You can do okay. If you've got someone that really cares about you, cares about your game and is pushing you to the limits and has the experience to call on as well and can talk about playing in those big moments and can fully empathise with what you're going through, it's worth its weight in gold. So I've got no doubt that if Shay Given decides to continue down this path and do another 10, 15 years as a goalkeeper coach, he'll have some incredible goalkeeper coaches that will come through his ranks and go to the very top level.
Well, that's it for another week on the Goalkeepers Union podcast. Remember, if there's anything you'd like us to ask our respective guests when they come on the show, easy to let us know. Hello at goalkeepersunion.net or on Twitter at GK Union. We'll see you next time.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.